This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. We inherit many things from our parents, our eye color, our mannerisms, and often a rooting interest in sports. Our next story is about a family with stronger-than-usual ties to a team and an 11-year-old boy who turned his family's fandom into an unexpected moment of internet glory. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
The Lucas family has supported the University of North Carolina since forever. Adam Lucas says his grandfather was a big UNC basketball fan. Adam's grandmother used to tell him stories of her days waiting tables at the Carolina Coffee Shop in Chapel Hill, where she served future College Football Hall of Famer Charlie Choo Choo Justice, UNC class of 1949. One Sunday afternoon, when Adam was young, his father drove him to Carmichael Arena. That's where Carolina played basketball back then, just on the off chance that the doors would be open. They were. Adam snuck in and shot a free throw on the very same court where his idols played ball. He remembers thinking it was the coolest thing ever. And did you really drop out of law school so you could watch more games?
That is a fairly succinct summary of what did happen. Made it through the first semester of law school at Carolina, and then in the second semester is when the law school classes started interfering with the Carolina basketball games. My contracts professor, who was also a big Carolina basketball fan, he called me into class one day. I'm pretty sure that was an 8:30 class, and so I had probably been a little sleepy because Carolina had a 9 o'clock basketball game the night before. And we were standing up at the front of the class, and he said, "I want you to look out at this classroom and see all those chairs." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Everyone who sits in those chairs feels about law the same way you feel about Carolina basketball." And I said, "I don't feel that way about law." And he said, "I can tell." And I took that as a very subtle hint that perhaps I should find something that would enable me to spend more time with what I loved and let the people who love the law pursue that.
Adam found that he could make a living writing about Carolina basketball. So that's what he's doing. He's a columnist for UNC's official website and has written 6 books about Tar Heels basketball. He got married. He and his wife Jennifer started a family. First came their daughter McKay. She prefers ballet to basketball. And then one March afternoon in 2005, Adam was in Washington, D.C. for the ACC tournament when he got a call from Jennifer. She had just been at the doctor's office, and while she was not in labor yet, the doctor said that their son would be arriving ahead of schedule.
He was not willing to wait anymore, and I think he also knew Carolina was going to win the national championship that year, and so he wanted to make sure he was around to see that.
Adam did not abandon his post to rush home. He waited until his job was done.
Well, Carolina cooperated and lost. You don't typically want them to lose, but when it enabled things to move along a little more rapidly, that was better.
Carolina had better luck during the NCAA tournament, and Asher was born just weeks before the Tar Heels won the national championship. He doesn't remember that one, but he and his father have attended many more ACC championships and Final Fours together. Asher says sometimes they bring the rest of the family, but sometimes they don't.
Mostly just getting to go with him as a fun experience and getting to go see what we both love.
Asher didn't have to sneak into the Smith Center, where UNC now plays, to find out what it was like to stand on the court. Thanks to his dad's connections, Asher was allowed to come down from the stands to help rebound during warm-ups.
And then one game, one of the managers, Eric Hoots, he asked if I wanted a ball boy and, like, stay on the basket. So I was like, yeah, sure, that sounds cool. And so after that game, I've just started doing that full-time.
Full-time when you're 11 apparently means when you're not at school or doing homework or practicing with your own sports teams or sleeping or eating or doing chores. Asher takes his responsibilities seriously, and Adam's always there to make sure he's doing a good job.
If I have time in between watching the ball boy, I do try to write something about the game.
But it was Adam's responsibility to write something about the game that almost made him miss the most important moment in Asher's young life. It was a little more than a month ago, Sunday, January 8th. Carolina was playing NC State.
That game had actually been delayed by a day. We got some snow down here in North Carolina, And the game was supposed to be played on Saturday night, but because of the snow and the cold weather, it was pushed back to Sunday afternoon.
During the first half, we did very well, and the crowd had been cheering the entire time. And so when we went to halftime, the crowd was like, okay, we can relax some after yelling so much.
During halftime, I typically go back sort of underneath the stands. I have some stuff that I need to write at halftime. And so when I was going back there, I saw Asher and the other ball boys coming out, and they had basketballs in their hands, which they typically don't at halftime. But because the game had been delayed, and I guess a couple other reasons, there was no set halftime show on this day. I remember thinking, oh boy, I should probably keep an eye on this in case things get out of hand or something crazy happens. But I went back and started writing a little bit.
While Adam was under the bleachers writing, Asher and his friend Grant decided that they'd entertain the crowd by trying a couple half-court shots. They'd done it before, usually pregame, so Asher had already developed a ritual for heaving the ball.
I'm more of a superstitious person, and so I'll do the same thing every time.
Asher's ritual starts by holding a finger down by his thigh. So if he hasn't hit a half-court shot yet that day, he'll hold a one.
So hold the one down, dribble a little bit high, and then stutter step, dribble again, take like a crow hop almost, and then heave it from my shoulder. Because I can't exactly get there off a straight normal shot.
It's a little too far away.
Yes, ma'am. After the first one, they're like, hey, he made a half-court shot. Good job. Then after the second one, I was like, oh, wow, he made two in a row. That's hard.
Then I saw my wife was calling me. And so by the time I put together the crowd cheering with the fact that I had seen the ball boys holding basketballs, being a really smart guy, I eventually figured out I should probably take a look at what was going on.
I'm like, this is nuts. There's no way I can make three. But let's try it, because the crowd's excited. You don't want to just stop there.
Stuck my head out in time to see the third one, and he made that third one. Everybody went crazy.
The crowd went nuts when I made three. It felt amazing, because I don't really know anybody that made three half-court shots before, and it's really hard to do.
Certainly, I know for sure that I couldn't have done it, and I couldn't have been more proud that he did it.
The video on YouTube has tens of thousands of views. Adam jokes that his family is responsible for half of them. I wouldn't ask most 11-year-olds where they plan to go to college, but I figured I was safe with Asher.
I'm probably going to go to UNC if they give me an offer. I probably will.
Well, first he's got to get in. He's in the sixth grade, so he's got a ways to go. Let's don't put it on the board yet. I'd like him to go wherever he's happy. If that includes playing sports, then that's great. And if that includes playing the trumpet or something, he doesn't play the trumpet, but if he decides that he likes it, then he can go do that. He does not have to go to the University of North Carolina. If he finds a place that's a better fit for him, then that's where he needs to be.
So I could go to Duke if I wanted?
If you could pay for it.
Oh, never mind. What about state?
If you could pay for it.
I get the feeling this isn't the first time Asher Lucas has teased his father with this idea. Adam has his reply at the ready. With thousands of schools with great programs all around the country, he says, there's no need to go to a rival. And as much as 11-year-old boys like to push boundaries, Asher does not disagree. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Here at Only a Game, we love stories about all athletes, big and small, professional, and barely counts as amateur. If you have a story of athletic prowess or lack thereof that you think we'd be interested in, send us an email at oag@wbur.org. I remember elementary school gym class. We played a lot of bombardment. You may know the game by another name, dodgeball, maybe. I think some kids called it murder ball. Maybe they still do. Probably they don't. It wasn't that violent. It was pretty violent. The gym class was divided in half. Each group occupied half the gymnasium floor. There was a line in the middle of that varnished floor that may have been black, although it may have been red. The doors of the gym led to a long windowless corridor, which is where we all knelt with our hands over our heads when there was a nuclear attack drill. I mention the corridor so that you'll know about when these games of bombardment were happening. Anyway, a teacher, probably happy to have to do nothing beyond tossing a few volleyballs into the scrum, did that. The more athletic boys and perhaps a couple of girls scooped up the balls and threw them at the most vulnerable children cringing against the wall on the other side of the line. If you were hit with a ball, you were out of the game, meaning the exercise you got was sitting and watching. If you caught the ball when somebody threw it at you, the person throwing it was out of the game, meaning he or she was the one who had to sit and watch. Simple. The weak and timid were eliminated quickly. Soon it was only the more athletic competitors rearing back and firing balls at each other. Their misses slammed into the tile walls of the gym with a satisfactory bang. I can still hear the echoes. Nobody wore a helmet. In those days, nobody riding a bicycle wore a helmet either. Our parents' cars didn't have seat belts. The streets were choked with dying people who might have lived had there been penicillin. Nah, I made up that last part. Anyway, bombardment. But that wasn't the only game we played. Sometimes we took turns shooting basketballs. On those days, nearly all of the exercise we all got consisted of standing in line, waiting for our turns. Then each of us who actually played basketball would step to the foul line and take a shot. The others cheated. I don't remember whether the shots that went in were greeted with cheers. I don't remember whether shots that missed were greeted with derision. I do remember one particular girl who couldn't have cared less whether her shots went in, or at least that's the way she played it. Her name was Debbie Lombardi, probably no relation to Coach Vince Lombardi, who may or may not have said, "Winning isn't everything, it's the only thing." Debbie Lombardi would take the ball when it was her turn, fling it in the direction of the basket, and turn away, muttering, "The heck with it." Somebody nicknamed her "The Heck With It Lombardi." Probably nobody called her that except during gym. I hope they didn't. I hope I didn't. There's much more ahead on Only a Game, but first, Seattle Photog recently left this review of our show on iTunes. Only a Game gives us a good look at the other stories hidden by big pro sports coverage. Thanks, OAG. Thanks to you as well, Seattle Photog. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. We enjoy reading them, and it really does help other listeners to find our show. We're going to start this week's three stories you should know by talking about the Super Bowl, but not the actual game.
Welcome to America.
You're not wanted here. Go back home.
It's the ads we're going to talk about. My guests this time around are Mina Kimes of ESPN The Magazine and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to start this week. A woman and her daughter get up early and begin a difficult journey, and they speak Spanish. People of different races and colors blend into each other while music celebrating diversity plays in the background. And a German guy endures hardships coming to the U.S. where one resident tells him he's not welcome. Go back home. We're given to understand the German guy is going to become a successful businessman. Never mind what products or services are being celebrated in these Super Bowl ads. Could you watch them without thinking that the corporations and the ad agencies that made them weren't responding to policies hostile to immigrants? Because I couldn't, and I'm encouraged. Or am I imagining this corporate dismay at divisiveness?
I don't think you're imagining anything. You know, I was at the Super Bowl, so I missed the commercials, but I watched them afterwards, and I was pretty stunned. It does feel like in sports, we've sort of crossed some kind of Rubicon when it comes to politics. You know, you've got athletes like Russell Wilson and Steph Curry, who are very similar to brands in that they try to be as inoffensive as possible or historically have tried to do that. But now they're taking stances with regards to politics. And I think that suggests not so much that there's a fundamental shift in brands or athletes, but maybe in the norms that are being created by the new administration of what is possible.
I do think that this is definitely a conscious decision on the part of brands and advertisers, and whether it's directly about the election or directly about what was kicked up before the election, I think it's certainly tapping into something like that. at the same time, I still remember, I'm old enough to remember in 1984, the Apple ad with Big Brother. And that didn't necessarily represent any ending of an Orwellian universe, at least if I remember the mid to late 80s correctly.
It is important, I think, to reiterate something that you started to say, Mina, about current athletes and their positions in this. We're now up to 6 New England Patriots who have announced that they will not participate in the team's White House visit, never mind that the owner, the coach, and the quarterback are friends of the president. I got to wonder if this is going to have an impact beyond football, beyond basketball, beyond the particular teams and athletes involved.
It's so interesting because it's football, too, which is kind of been a space where this doesn't happen. You know, when we see basketball players and coaches speaking up, it feels normal and accepted at this point. But the NFL has long been so relatively benign. So to see these kinds of stances being taken by NFL players and during the biggest game, I think is telling of something bigger than the sport itself.
I've been watching this from baseball's point of view, and they dodged a bullet, actually, because the Chicago Cubs visited the White House just before Obama left.
Yeah.
It's something I think they're very happy to see basketball and football grapple with for a little while longer.
Is that a phenomenon that you anticipate, though?
I do, actually. I think when spring training starts next week, you're going to start to see a lot of articles about the divide in clubhouses, because the most outspoken baseball players tend to be very conservative, rural people, vote overwhelmingly Republican, support Trump. There is a largely silent but increasingly noisy minority of players, primarily in the Latino Hispanic community, that are very, very upset about this, aren't big fans of Trump, and I think you're going to see a lot more vocal players about that.
Okay, Craig, before it's your turn to bring up a topic, I just want to warn our listeners who consider themselves baseball purists that this next story may be upsetting to them, but go ahead.
I hope you're sitting down, but this week, Major League Baseball, which is 50 years into the designated hitter experience and still having a lot of controversy about it, announced that they're going to be using the minor leagues as an experiment, as a laboratory for speeding up the games. And one of the things that they propose, and it's going to be happening in rookie ball, is extra inning games will start with a runner on second base. The idea here is to increase the likelihood of scoring early in extra innings, cutting down the possibility of a 14, 15, 16 inning game. Kind of radical. It's been used in the World Baseball Classic a little bit differently. And it's just part of a lot of experiments that MLB has been undertaking lately to try to shorten games. We're talking pitch clocks. They're thinking about getting rid of the intentional walk, or at least getting rid of the pitches required to issue an intentional walk. Very radical for a very conservative baseball league.
To me, this seems kind of like a solution or in search of a problem, maybe. I don't know. I cannot even think of that many games I watched over the course of the last few seasons that went this far. I think it's probably in the single digits, right, where I can think of a number of games that were lopsided affairs but just kind of dragged on slowly because of incessant pitching changes and batters taking forever between. And those seem to be like real problems that maybe need to be solved.
I have some other ideas for speeding up the game. Every other hitter starts with a count of 3-2. 3 foul balls and you're out. And batters who walk are required to try to steal second base on the first pitch to the next batter. You like it?
Ooh. I like that one.
I'm going for one inning only, but you have 27 outs. And what that will do is get rid of the commercial breaks.
Oh, that's another excellent idea. All these things that people have tried to do to speed up baseball, they haven't worked. You know, when you start penalizing that guy who steps out and works on his batting gloves for 20 minutes before he steps back in, that's when you'll see a change. But they don't do it.
They've had the rules on the books, too. They've had the rules on the books forever for this, and they don't enforce it because why should they? They don't want to get into a fight with the players. And the real issue is the style of play in Major League Baseball and as it's developed, which has made games drag more. You have a lot more walks, a lot more strikeouts, pitch counts go longer, and there are more pitching changes. Major League Baseball is not prepared to actually make rules that will change the fundamental play of the game. They're trying to do things around the edges that, frankly, are just annoying people.
Mina, we have saved your story for last because, quite frankly, it is the most important of the three.
It's an outrage, is what it is. So last week, the Westminster Kennel Club announced that cats were going to be allowed in to the dog show. Now I should correct it. It's not actually the dog show, and they clarified they're going to let cats do some kind of display before an event in February called Meet the Breeds, and I think the cats will get to have their own agility competition. I don't know what kind of agility competition cats can have other than laying around and looking agile, but they bow down to pressure from the cat lobby, the cat industrial complex, I think. So now that this is happening, and look, it's hard to make a case against allowing cats in. That doesn't run counter to my fundamental beliefs in inclusiveness, but I am going to try. Full disclosure, I am a dog lover, a cat hater. Because cats and dogs, they're not like men and women or people from different countries. They are different species, and they appeal to different audiences. So as a dog enthusiast, I do not want to tune into the dog show, which I love, and see a bunch of weird-looking, apathetic cats.
Craig, you want to make a case for cats?
Well, as the person who, as speaking to you, is in a room with literally four cats at the moment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I will say I am slightly triggered. However, I will I will rise above these petty provocations. I understand that Mina would like a cat ban, and maybe she won't call it a cat ban when
wow.
we take her to court over it, but I understand what this is motivated about. I think America's better than that, and look forward to next year's Super Bowl ads dealing with cats primarily and our acceptance of them.
Has anybody polled the cats to see whether they want to be in this show? Because I've never seen any evidence in a cat that the cat wants to do anything for the owner at all.
Cats have self-actualization, right? And they're not desperately trying to please others in that way that dogs do, which, hey, you know, if it makes a dog feel better, that's great. But I think a cat is its own cat.
Well, maybe if a cat is its own cat, it should have its own cat show.
Bingo.
Boy, that's almost racist.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Mina Kimes of ESPN, the magazine, and Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Some bowl for glory. Not very many, probably. Some bowl because they're asked to do it. That's what happened my senior year when my residential college's intramural bowling team was short a member. I went along, and that's how I got the opportunity to bowl against John Hersey, who wrote Hiroshima, A Bell for Adano, and lots of other fine books. Much more recently, at a bowling night meant to encourage everybody who works at WBUR to bond, I bowled enough strikes to encourage the boss to express astonishment, which was curiously satisfying. Also, my team won, and we were presented with chocolate. Good times. But enough about me. Gary Wallach has the story of a man whose considerably more significant bowling achievement is still celebrated in bowlodromes throughout the land.
Why are people still talking about this? That's so many years ago. But I guess my story is not a typical story.
Except that it was typical, at least at first. It started on a busy Monday night at Plano Super Bowl, January 18th, 2010. It was a league night, and all 48 lanes were in use. Bill Fong's Crazy Eights team took lanes 27 and 28. Fong racked up his favorite bowling balls he himself had drilled and began his practice routine.
Some people practice and they try to score. When I practice, I actually work on little things like, you know, your timing and trying to pick up a 10-pin. So I was working on my footwork that day, and I really wasn't even striking that much in practice. And when people look up on the monitor, they say, hey, you're not bowling too well. I says, hey, I'm just working on some things.
Fong's meticulous approach made him one of Plano Super Bowl's best bowlers and earned him a reputation around the league as maybe something slightly more than that.
People used to call me like a robot because I used to strike a lot. And so they says, you're just like a robot. You're like a striking machine. So, yeah, I could get into that zone sometimes. And basically, that's what happened that night. I was throwing a new ball that I just drilled up. I think I had two of them, and I wound up striking for the 300. So they announced my name and said, Bill Fong just shot 300.
A perfect game. That's bowling glory, right? Not for Bill Fong. He still had two games to go.
In the second game, I switched balls on the right lane. And that spooked everybody. And they're like, why would you switch? And I said, well, I can't keep on throwing hard. And I threw it, and it struck. And I was like, okay, that's where I'm going to be. So I kept on striking. And they announced, Bill Fong shot 300 again. And the crowd started building after the second 300. If you get three 300 games, basically that's making a statement.
Let's consider that statement. A perfect series, also known as a 900, is three consecutive games of 300, or 36 consecutive strikes. The United States Bowling Congress began keeping track of perfect series in 1997. Only 15 had been officially recognized by the time Bill Fong had his shot at one in 2010. But for Fong, rolling one more 300 game was about more than joining that elite company. A night of perfection might have filled what he has called an emptiness in his life. He had an unhappy childhood and did poorly in school. Later, his marriage failed. He moved from his native Chicago to Texas, where he worked as an amateur ball driller and sometimes gave haircuts in the back of the pro shop. But Fong wanted to be a pro bowler to attract media attention and sponsorship deals. Fong believed that a 900 would put him on the fast lane to that goal. That should have made him nervous that night, but
I was still very loose. And it was like everybody just stopped bowling and came over to watch, I guess, history being made.
Going into the 10th frame of the third game, Fong had rolled 33 consecutive strikes. His friend began recording the streak on his phone. His next throw, his 34th of the night, almost ended the streak.
I would say that was my luckiest strike, because I hit the pocket and it tripped the four and the nine.
The nine pin wobbled tantalizingly, and then it fell.
Help out.
And I looked back and I just seen the hundreds of people standing behind me, and then it went quiet. I knew something special was happening. You're in this trance, it's hard to explain. It's something I've never felt before. And so the last shot, I just went up there and thought, maintain your speed, positive thoughts. And I threw it, and I just didn't feel like I threw it 100%. It was more like hoping.
He's got it out. Come on! Oh!
I left the 10 pin, and then all I heard was, aw. Hundreds of people all said, aw, at the same time. Aw, it wasn't falling down. It hit me. I didn't get my 900 that I shot 899.
Fong was consoled by his friends and given a round of applause. He had not accomplished the elusive perfect series, but he had captured the Texas State record of 899 pins, surpassing an 890 rolled in 2002. Dropping all those pins had made Fong hungry.
I went home and I cooked up some soup. I was eating and all of a sudden my body felt warm. And I went to the restroom and I was barfing uncontrollably. And then blood started coming out. And I just fell down onto the carpet and the room was spinning like crazy. And I says, hey, what's going on? And my only thought that night was, let me climb upstairs to my bedroom and hopefully I'll sleep it off and this will go away. I just had the best bowling night of my life and now I just feel close to death. So luckily the next day I woke up and it turned out it was a stroke I had that night. People said that the adrenaline of shooting 900 might have killed me, that because I didn't shoot 900, that I might have survived.
Later in 2010, Fong had open-heart surgery at just 46 years old. He survived, despite a 70% chance that he wouldn't.
I'm glad to be alive to tell the story. And now it's changed my life.
Fong owns a successful pro shop called Bowling Medic. It's right across K Avenue from Plano's Super Bowl. There, he drills high-tech bowling balls with swirly fluorescent finishes for slightly starstruck customers. He says now his passion is watching others improve. He changed the span and pitch of a friend's finger holds a couple weeks ago, and his friend threw a 300. But he still bowls, and he sometimes thinks about what almost was.
When I bowl a league, I'm still like that robot. I could string a lot of strikes, and that haven't changed. But to shoot a 900, it's kind of like you need a perfect night. You need all the stars aligned. I mean, I hope I do one day.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
Since January 18th, 2010, that day of days for Mr. Fong, 16 bowlers have registered 900s. As far as we know, there is no record of how many have rolled 899. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style, coming up on Only a Game. After a rock struck him in the head, climber Paul Pritchard had to wait hours for help to arrive.
I didn't really know whether I would live or die.
That's just ahead, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Jesse Graff, Xena fan, stunt woman, and trailblazing ninja warrior. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Trailblazing ninja commenter that I am.
Yeah, exactly. It's what I'm expecting every week. We haven't spoken since the most extraordinary comeback in Super Bowl history. You have always maintained that the Super Bowl is good. I suppose now you'll have to say it's better.
It's great. That was one of the most amazing sporting events I've ever seen. Almost beyond category, what the Patriots did. And as much as a lot of people around the country don't like the team, that's really too bad. You're going to have to deal with this.
That's right. Super Bowl 51 saw the first ever Super Bowl overtime. Is the overtime rule, the way it applies in the Super Bowl, a good thing?
I don't know. People are arguing about it now. I always am in favor of playing the thing out, like playing another quarter until somebody wins or loses, the way the NHL does in its playoffs. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I didn't see any problem with it this year. I mean, all the Falcons have to do is make one stop.
Another Patriots victory has resulted in a debate this week among ex-players and ex-coaches about the numbers of NFL teams who have stolen signals, whether that's considered cheating in football. Baseball teams do it all the time. We take it for granted. Is stealing signals any more or less sleazy in football than it is in baseball?
No, I love it. It's pure gamesmanship. But, of course, football has this overlay of, you know, military covert ops thing that makes it sound more serious than it actually is. I just think it's wonderful gamesmanship.
It seems to me also that football has the technology. I mean, the film and video is so often involved. Baseball, it's just a wise old coach looking across the field and figuring things out, right?
Or some old dude in a building across the street with a set of binoculars.
Could be that, too. The Green Bay Packers announced this week that they were releasing cornerback Sam Shields. He has missed a lot of time over the past two seasons because of concussions and after effects. Of the headaches that he is still suffering, Shields said recently, "I'm so used to it now, it's just normal." Please tell me he's not going to seek employment with another team.
He's going to seek employment with another team, but I doubt very seriously if another team's going to hire him. And he needs to talk to his doctor about his attitude towards those headaches.
Absolutely. I know that you're a big fan of the Miami Marlins owner, Jeffrey Loria.
Chop shop.
Yeah. He's apparently looking to sell the team for about $1.6 billion, which is a lot of money. Any rumors circling around about who might own it next?
Yes. Charles Kushner, who's already done some time in the pokey for being somewhat of a fraudster, but who is Ivanka Trump's father-in-law, is actually sniffing around buying the team. And I'm sure the other owners in baseball are delighted to hear that.
Last year, Leicester City's unlikely run to the top of the Premiership was the story that most amazed and delighted soccer fans. I guess this year they're going to have to find another story to amaze and delight them.
Yeah, blooms off the rose. They may wind up getting relegated, which will make the next time they win the league all that sweeter and a much better story.
And maybe it'll be next year.
That's right. It's feast or famine in Leicester City.
On Wednesday night, former New York Knick Charles Oakley was ejected from Madison Square Garden during a Knicks game, and he was arrested after he apparently got into a shouting match with Knicks owner James Dolan and allegedly punched three security guards. What's going on here?
Well, Charles Oakley has become a hero in New York for getting into a brawl with James Dolan, whom nobody likes. They chanted Charles Oakley's name at the Ranger game the next night. And I suspect if they come to court, they're going to have to try him in Upper Michigan because there's no way they can get an impartial jury in New York.
LaMelo Ball plays basketball for Chino Hills High School. His brother, LiAngelo Ball, is usually the team's high scorer, but he was injured when Chino Hills took on Los Osos High this week, would it be an understatement to say LaMelo took up the slack?
He went up and put up 92, and of course, their big brother Alonzo is one of the real stars of college basketball this year at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to see the Bell brothers playing in a driveway, because I think that would be a lot of fun. I think there's probably another brother that doesn't do anything but pass, but they don't talk about him.
And finally, Charlie, a group of former Philadelphia Flyers is heading to Russia to play some exhibition games this month. Joe Watson, a former defenseman for the Flyers, says that he's learned that Vladimir Putin wants to play against that team. Do you suppose he'll wear a shirt?
I hope he wears a shirt, and I hope they don't try to check him. I hope they let him score, because he is, after all, the original Broad Street Bully.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Paul Pritchard worries about how he talks. Sometimes he worries enough to think he should apologize.
I hope you realize my speech is a bit stilted because of my head injury.
I had been told that, and so I've got lots and lots of time, and I'm just happy to be able to talk to you. Pritchard grew up in Wales. As a youngster, he was no athlete, which may have explained, at least in part, why he had the leisure to dabble in delinquency.
When I was young, when I was about 14, I was a bit of a bad lad, and I used to throw petrol bombs at climbers and set the moors on fire.
Happily, before he could travel far on the path to criminal excess, young Pritchard was rescued, and it wouldn't be the last time that happened.
A teacher said that we could go climbing instead of doing football or some other team sports, which I was always rubbish at. And so I tried climbing and found that I was good at something for the first time in my life, and that really calmed me down.
Climbing was life-changing. Pritchard says moving up and along a rock face was like poetry. The better he got at it, the more ambitious he became. Eventually, he was recognized as one of the most accomplished climbers in Great Britain, and then one day he came across a magazine photograph of a sea stack in Tasmania called the Totem Pole. A sea stack is a kind of pillar that rises from the ocean near the coastline. You can find them in lots of places.
But this one was the most slender sea stack in the world. It was 4 meters wide by 65 meters high. And it was just absolutely amazing, this picture. And when you see the totem pole, it's one of the wildest kind of things that come out of the sea in the world. And it even sways in the wind. It's so flimsy.
So, of course, Paul Pritchard decided he'd better climb it. On Friday, February 13th, 1998, at the age of 31, off he went to the totem pole. But when he and his then-girlfriend Celia got their first look at it...
It actually appears quite disappointing because the headland is 120 meters high and the candlestick, which is beyond the totem pole, is a 120-meter high sea stack. But the totem pole is only 65 meters high, so you struggle to see it when you first look down upon it. But then when you get level with it, then that's when you see it in all its glory.
Paul and Celia climbed down the headland until they were level with the top of the sea stack. Then they made their way to the top of the totem pole via a rope strung between the cliff and the summit of the stack. The plan was to climb down from the summit, then climb back up and call it a day. Part one of that plan went well enough. Paul went first.
And I put my rope ascending clamps onto the rope, and I took up the slack about five moves, and then swung around the edge like a corner of a house. And that's the last thing that I knew. I didn't notice any sound or even a strike. The next thing that I remember was that Celia was by me, trying to get me upright in slings. Blood was pouring from my head into the sea because I was upside down.
Paul Pritchard had taken a rock to the head, a rock about the size of a flat-screen computer monitor. It had fallen 30 feet and cracked his skull before dropping into the sea. Bits of the rock were left behind in Pritchard's brain. Celia climbed down to Pritchard and began hauling him up the cliff.
And the first time that I remember that something was drastically wrong with me was when she was trying to get me onto the ledge 3 hours later. And, you know, I was drifting in and out of consciousness. She said, "You're going to have to help me here if we're to get you out of this, you know." And I tried to help her, and that's when I realised neither my right arm nor my right leg were working. They were like a corpse's.
Somehow, Celia manoeuvred Pritchard into a position where he could use his left hand to pull himself onto the ledge. She secured him and went for help.
God knows what was going through her mind then. You know, she was probably thinking that it's the last time that she'd see me alive. And then she had to run 8 kilometres for help because it was in the days before mobile phones.
Alone on that ledge, Paul Pritchard wondered whether he'd live. He knew he was still losing blood. He knew that he hadn't been able to move enough to help much with his own rescue.
I knew that I'd done something really awful to myself. I knew that I had to stay awake. I thought that if I did go to sleep, it might be the last sleep that I ever made.
About 8 hours after the accident, Celia and a paramedic named Neil Smith returned to the totem pole. It wasn't easy, but they managed to get Pritchard off the rock. He found himself suspended above a small boat.
We call them tinnies in Australia, and the swell was such that it was rising and falling for about 6 feet. And so Neil had to take his penknife and cut the rope just on the upswell so that we fell into the boat. It's quite dramatic. I lost half my blood.
Half your blood?
Yeah, like 4 litres.
After another 2 hours, Paul Pritchard finally reached a hospital where doctors would begin to assess the damage.
Then they put me into an induced coma for 4 days. When I came round out of that coma, I didn't know where I was. I thought that the nurses were trying to kill me. I was really hallucinating badly, but I think that was just the drugs that they put me on. I found that I couldn't talk. I was really confused. My right arm and right leg felt like still, you know, they were cold. My face was all droopy on the right side. So it was like a massive stroke.
In the frightening months that followed the accident, a couple of doctors told Pritchard he'd never walk again. Sometimes he felt depressed. On other days, he despaired.
Because I thought that I would never climb again. And I had a whole room full of expedition gear. You know, ropes and sleeping bags, ice axes, crampons. I decided to sell it all. I remember crying once when this guy came asking to buy my skis. You know, so depressed that I needed medication.
At some point during those days, Paul Pritchard began to realize that the climbing he'd done had prepared him for the challenges he was now facing. As he put it, the mountains had been a good teacher. Pritchard was in a wheelchair for about 9 months, a wheelchair he had to operate with only one hand, which was frustrating. Who wants to travel in circles? Maybe that's where he found the determination to teach himself to walk again, and then to climb.
About 18 months after my accident, I climbed a hill in Wales. It took quite a few hours. It was just a small hill above my village.
5 years later, Pritchard climbed Mount Kenya. 2 years after that, in 2005, in the company of an all-disabled team, he climbed Kilimanjaro. But even as he was taking on those challenges, Pritchard encountered hostility. He was beaten up, once in the street, once at a party. He could see no reason for it beyond the fact that he struggled to walk and to talk. Pritchard continued to climb. He says part of it was just wanting to get back to the joy of being outdoors and sleeping in the dirt. Simultaneously, recovery was teaching Pritchard something about the brain, or at least about his brain, within which the undamaged parts were beginning to compensate for what had been lost.
You never stop recovering. It's not like a peripheral nerve injury, like a broken back or something, where you don't really ever recover. So for me, even 2 years ago, 16 years after my injury, I started to be able to tap my foot.
So it's something new every day.
Well, maybe something new every year. It's pretty slow, this plasticity business.
Meanwhile, Pritchard and his climbing buddies began devising a system of ropes and pulleys that would enable Paul to undertake more ambitious climbs. You can see where this is headed, right? Those innovations, his own determination, and that plasticity Paul mentioned eventually enabled him to return to the scene of his accident. In April of 2016, he went back to the totem pole.
The totem pole, for me, it caused me so much pain, and it needed to be returned to. I think that to come full circle after 18 years, it was something quite profound about it. I took the very same swing that I took all those years ago, which caused me so much damage. So that was really, really quite frightening for me. I had to climb up this rope to the ledge with my one hand. And pulling onto the ledge, you know, I had these really powerful flashbacks of Celia shouting to me in my brain. And then when I actually got on to the summit, my legs were below the summit and my body, my torso was above it, and I couldn't, it was the same deal really as when I was trying to get onto the ledge the day of my accident, and then that was it, I was on the summit, and it felt like I was realizing a long-held dream.
Returning to the totem pole and completing that climb brought Paul Pritchard considerable attention, especially in Australia, where he now lives. These days, he still climbs and bikes and kayaks on adapted machinery, but he also visits schools one day each week to demonstrate what a disabled person can accomplish.
If you're a disabled person, it seems like you can only really ever be one of two things, and that's either a passive victim or someone who's succeeding against all odds. And I'm neither. I'm just a normal bloke, really. I might seem to be succeeding against all odds, but that's positive discrimination. I don't climb anywhere near as hard as I used to. I don't feel special in any way.
Having heard Paul Pritchard's story, you may feel otherwise. His protests to the contrary, he'd probably understand. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Ryan Fitzgerald. Our final word comes from Paul Pritchard, who compared his use of ropes to climb the totem pole to my use of glasses to read.
You know, so with support, all people, disabled or not, are capable of quite extraordinary things.
Okay, but grant me that you've climbed pretty high on the scale of extraordinary things, Paul. All right, if you won't say it, I will. He has. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.